A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and he's basically asking us to pull out a microscope and look at what's actually happening when you press enter on a URL or fire off an API call. He says whenever he opens Postman and stares at custom headers, form data, authentication tokens, the whole thing kind of washes over him. So he wants us to walk through the anatomy of a modern API request, the cascade from DNS to response, what those headers actually mean, how authentication works, and why any of this matters when we're talking about the magic that happens between your browser and a server. There's a lot to unpack here.
This is genuinely one of those topics where most people, even developers, operate on a kind of fuzzy mental model. They know requests happen, they know headers exist, but the actual structure and lifecycle is just hand-waved away. It's worth getting concrete.
Before we dive in, though, quick note. Today's episode script is being generated by DeepSeek 5.4 Pro, so if anything lands particularly well, credit where it's due.
All right, let's start with the cascade. When Daniel says press enter on a URL, what actually kicks off? Because there's a whole symphony before a single byte of HTML or JSON ever comes back.
And I think most people imagine it's just browser ask server, server responds. But the prelude is where a lot of the interesting decisions get made.
Step one is DNS. The browser needs an IP address, and it doesn't just ask once. It checks its own cache first. Has it resolved this domain recently, then the operating system cache. If both miss, it queries a DNS resolver, typically your ISP's, over UDP on port 53. That resolver does a recursive lookup through root servers, then top-level domain servers, then the authoritative name server for that domain. Each step narrows the scope until you get an IP address, which then gets cached according to its TTL, time to live. If the whole chain fails, you get a resolution error and the browser never even attempts a connection.
The TTL thing is quietly important. If a site is doing a DNS failover, maybe they're switching between servers for maintenance. A short TTL means the new IP propagates quickly. A long TTL means faster subsequent loads but slower recovery if something changes. There's a whole operational philosophy baked into that number.
And DNS is one of those protocols that feels ancient but is absolutely foundational. It runs over UDP by default. No handshake, no guaranteed delivery. Which is why it's fast, but also why DNS spoofing and cache poisoning have been persistent attack vectors. There's DNS over HTTPS now, which encrypts the query, but that's a whole separate conversation.
Now we have an IP address. What's next?
TCP three-way handshake. The browser sends a SYN packet to port 443, that's the HTTPS port, the server responds with SYN ACK, and the browser sends ACK back. Three packets, and now you have a reliable, full duplex channel. The sequence numbers in those packets are what let TCP reassemble things in order and detect packet loss. It's elegant, but it also adds latency, one round trip before any actual data moves.
This is where the difference between HTTP versions starts to matter, right? Because the handshake overhead gets compounded if you're opening and closing connections constantly.
In the old HTTP 1.0 days, every request was a new TCP connection. Handshake, request, response, tear it down. HTTP 1.1 introduced persistent connections with keep alive, so you could reuse the same connection for multiple requests. But you still had head-of-line blocking. One slow request held up everything behind it. HTTP 2 solved that with multiplexing over a single TCP connection, using binary framing instead of the old text-based request line. And HTTP 3 goes even further. It ditches TCP entirely and runs over QUIC, which is built on UDP. That eliminates TCP-level head-of-line blocking and reduces connection establishment latency significantly.
Here's the thing that I think trips people up. When you're writing code or looking at Postman, you're thinking in HTTP 1.1 semantics, methods, paths, headers as text. But the actual bytes on the wire might be HTTP2 binary frames or quickstreams. The browser's DevTools shows you the semantic representation, not the raw wire format. There's a translation layer.
That's such a good point. The abstraction is so clean that most developers never need to think about the wire format. But when you're debugging something weird, latency spikes, connection resets, strange ordering, understanding what's actually happening underneath becomes essential. The tools lie to you in a helpful way.
All right, so DNS resolved, TCP connected. Now we hit TLS.
The TLS handshake is where things get cryptographically interesting. The client sends a client hello, here's what TLS versions I support, here are my cipher suites, here's a random number. The server responds with server hello. I choose this version, this cipher suite, and then sends its certificate. That certificate is signed by a certificate authority, and it contains the server's public key. The client verifies the certificate chain. Is this CA trusted? Is the certificate expired? Does the domain match? If all checks pass, the client generates a pre-master secret, encrypts it with the server's public key, and sends it. Both sides then derive symmetric session keys from that pre-master secret and the random numbers they exchanged. From that point on, everything is encrypted with those session keys.
TLS 1.3 streamlined this significantly. Fewer round trips, and it cut out older, weaker cipher suites entirely. Zero RTT resumption means if you've connected to a server before, you can send encrypted data in the very first packet. It's faster, but it does introduce some replay attack risks that the spec has to account for.
And there's a real tension here between speed and security. Zero RTT data can be replayed by an attacker, so it should only be used for idempotent requests, requests that produce the same result no matter how many times they're sent. GET requests are fine. Post requests that charge a credit card are not. The server can enforce this, but it's one of those subtle things that application developers rarely think about.
Now we've got an encrypted tunnel. DNS done, TCP done, TLS done. Now the actual HTTP request goes through. Let's talk about what that looks like.
In HTTP 1.1, the request starts with a request line, method, path, protocol version. So something like GET/API/users/HTTP/1.1. Then headers, which are key value pairs separated by colons. Then an empty line. Then an optional body. That's the structure. It's almost absurdly simple when you look at it.
The headers are where all the metadata lives, and that's where things get rich. What are the ones that actually matter?
The host header is mandatory in HTTP 1.1. It tells the server which domain you're trying to reach, which matters because a single server might host multiple domains. Content type tells the server how to interpret the body. Is it JSON, form encoded data, multi-part form data with file uploads? Accept tells the server what format the client wants back. Authorization carries credentials, bearer tokens, API keys, basic auth credentials. User agent identifies the client. Content length tells the server how many bytes to expect in the body.
Getting content type wrong is probably the single most common API debugging headache. You send JSON, but declare it as form data, the server parses it wrong, and you get a cryptic 400 bad request. Postman tries to help by auto-detecting, but it's not magic.
There's also a set of newer headers that are worth knowing about. The fetch metadata headers, secfetch, 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 mode, secfetch, dest. These tell the server about the request context. Is this a same origin request, a cross-site request, a navigation, a resource load? Servers can use these to reject suspicious requests before they even hit application logic. It's a defense-in-depth mechanism that's been rolling out across browsers over the past few years.
I hadn't dug into those. So, the browser is essentially annotating every request with enough context for the server to say, this fetch from a cross-site context looked sketchy. I'm rejecting it.
And then there are client hints, secch UA, secch UA platform, which provide device information in a more privacy-conscious way than the old user agent string. The server requests what it needs. The browser sends only that. And the priority header, RFC 9218, lets the client signal how urgent a resource is. A render-blocking CSS file gets high priority, a below-the-fold image gets low priority. This helps the server and any intermediate proxies allocate bandwidth intelligently.
Headers are doing a lot more work than people realize. They're not just metadata. They're a negotiation layer. The client declares capabilities and preferences. The server decides how to respond.
The body is where things get even more varied. JSON is the default now. Content. Type application/JSON, and it's human-readable, easy to parse, universally supported. But form data still matters. Application/XWWW form Erlang-coded is the classic web form format. Key equals value pairs separated by ampersands, with special characters percent encoded. It's simple but limited. Multi-part form data is for file uploads. Each part has its own headers and content, separated by a boundary string. It's more complex but handles binary data cleanly.
Then there's the parameter taxonomy. Query parameters, path parameters, header parameters, body parameters. Four different places to put data, and choosing wrong creates all sorts of problems.
Query parameters sit in the URL after the question mark. Great for filtering, searching, pagination. They're visible, bookmarkable, cacheable. Path parameters are part of the URL structure. /users/123 identifies a specific resource. They're for routing, not optional filters. Header parameters carry metadata and auth, things that apply to the whole request. Body parameters are for the actual payload, creating or updating a resource. Mixing these up leads to APIs that are confusing to use and hard to maintain.
I've seen APIs that put authentication tokens in query parameters, and every time I see that I wince. URLs get logged, cached, shared. That token is now in a dozen log files in your browser history.
That's a perfect segue into authentication. Let's talk about how API calls prove who they are.
Daniel specifically mentioned authenticated versus unauthenticated requests, and I think that distinction is more interesting than people realize. An unauthenticated request isn't necessarily public. It might be an internal API that assumes it's only called from the same origin, or it might rely on a cookie that the browser sends automatically.
This connects back to something we talked about before, the collapse of the distinction between internal and external APIs. The browser doesn't care about your organizational chart. If your front end can call an endpoint, anyone who inspects the network tab can see that endpoint and try to call it themselves.
Which is why authentication isn't just about, is this user logged in? It's about, do I trust this request at all? Let's walk through the common methods.
API keys are the simplest. It's a static string, basically a long password, that gets sent in a header, usually authorization:bearer:sum. The server checks it against a database or validates its format. Simple to implement, simple to use. But it has no concept of user identity. The key represents an application or a project, not a person. And if the key leaks, anyone can use it until it's revoked. There's no expiration built in.
They leak constantly. People commit them to GitHub. They show up in client-side JavaScript. They get logged accidentally. There are automated scanners that trawl public repos for API keys 24/7.
Bearer tokens, especially JWT, JSON Web Tokens, are the next step up. After a user logs in, the server issues a signed token that contains claims, user ID, expiration time, permissions. The client sends it in the authorization header. The server validates the signature and checks the expiration without needing to hit a database. It's stateless, which makes it great for microservices and distributed systems. But the trade-off is that anyone with the token can use it until it expires. There's no built-in revocation mechanism. If a token gets stolen, you either wait for it to expire or you maintain a blacklist, which defeats the statelessness.
JWT size is also a real issue. If you stuff too many claims in there, the token gets large, and it's sent with every request. On a mobile connection, that adds up. I've seen tokens that are several kilobytes. That's more overhead than the actual API response in some cases.
OAuth 2.0 is the industry standard for delegated access. The idea is that a user can grant a third-party application access to their data without sharing their password. The flow involves redirects, authorization codes, and token exchanges. The authorization code flow with PKCE, Proof Key for Code Exchange, is the current best practice for mobile and single-page apps. The older implicit flow is deprecated because it exposed tokens in the URL fragment. Client credentials is for machine-to-machine communication, no user involved.
OAuth is powerful, but it's also notoriously complex to implement correctly. The spec is long, the terminology is dense, and getting the redirect URIs right is a constant source of security vulnerabilities. I've seen production systems that accepted any redirect URI because the developer couldn't figure out how to validate it properly.
That's where the industry is converging on a pragmatic middle ground. Use API keys for internal services and quick prototypes where the blast radius is small. Use bearer tokens, often JWT, for user-facing production APIs. Use OAuth when you need third-party access or complex delegation. And never, ever use basic auth in production. It sends Base64 encoded credentials, which is essentially plaintext over HTTPS, and offers no expiration or scope limitation.
The over HTTPS part is doing a lot of work there. All of these methods assume the transport is encrypted. Send the bearer token over plain HTTP, and it's visible to every router between you and the server. TLS isn't optional anymore.
There's also MTLS, Mutual TLS, where both client and server present certificates. It's used in zero trust architectures and service mesh setups. The client certificate proves identity at the transport layer before any HTTP happens. It's extremely secure but operationally complex. Certificate management at scale is non-trivial.
Let's talk about the response side. The request goes out. What comes back?
Status line first, HTTP version, 3-digit status code, status message. 200 OK means success. 201. Created means a resource was created. 400 bad request means the server couldn't parse what you sent. 401 unauthorized means you need to authenticate. 403 forbidden means you're authenticated but not allowed. 404 not found. 500 internal server error means something broke on the server side. These codes are part of the HTTP spec, and using them correctly makes APIs predictable.
People get 401 and 403 confused constantly. 401 is, I don't know who you are. 403 is, I know who you are, and you're not allowed to do this. It's a subtle distinction, but it matters for debugging.
Response headers include content type, is the body JSON, HTML, binary? Content, length for the body size. Server header identifying the software. Cache. Control directives telling browsers and proxies how long to cache the response. And then the body, JSON for APIs, HTML for web pages, binary blobs for images and files.
One thing that's changed significantly is how cookies behave. Modern browsers default cookies to same site equals lax, meaning cookies aren't sent on cross-site sub-requests unless explicitly configured. If you're building an API that relies on cookies for authentication, and you're calling it from a different domain, you need same site equals none with a secure attribute. And there's a newer thing called chips, cookies, having independent partition state that further isolates third-party cookies per top-level site. The cookie model is getting more restrictive, which is good for privacy, but means developers need to understand these attributes.
This is where the gap between what Daniel described, opening Postman, looking at headers, feeling overwhelmed, and what's actually happening gets really interesting. When you load a modern website, your browser fires off dozens of API calls automatically. Analytics, CDN checks, authentication service pings, feature flag evaluations. Most of these are invisible to the user. They use cookies, lightweight tokens, or no authentication at all. The browser is a relentless API client that most people never see.
Postman is the opposite. You're consciously crafting one request at a time. You choose the method, set the headers, construct the body. It forces you to think about each element. The browser's cascade is automatic and opaque. The microscope Daniel mentioned, that's really what DevTools and Postman are. They make the invisible visible.
This connects to something Daniel mentioned in his prompt, MCP, the Model Context Protocol. This is Anthropic's open standard for connecting AI models to external tools and data sources. It essentially standardizes how an LLM makes API calls. The model doesn't construct raw HTTP. It uses MCP to describe what it wants to do, and the protocol handles the request formation.
The question becomes, if AI models are increasingly making API calls through abstraction layers like MCP, does understanding raw HTTP become more or less important for developers?
I think it becomes more important, but for a different reason. You're not writing the request by hand anymore, but you absolutely need to debug what the AI is doing. When the model hallucinates an endpoint or constructs a malformed request, you need to look at the actual HTTP to understand what went wrong. The abstraction leaks, and when it leaks, you need to know what's underneath.
That's where I land too. The skill shifts from authoring to auditing. You're not crafting headers in Postman as often, but you're inspecting AI-generated requests in logs, tracing why a call failed, understanding the auth flow that the model got wrong. The foundational knowledge doesn't go away, it just gets applied differently.
There's a security angle. If AI models are making API calls on behalf of users, the authentication model gets more complex. You're not just authenticating a user, you're authenticating a user delegating to an AI agent that's acting on their behalf. That's OAuth territory, but with an additional layer of indirection. Who holds the token? What scope does it have? Can the agent request additional permissions? These are questions the industry is just starting to grapple with.
The other thing I think about is that MCP and similar protocols are essentially standardizing the semantic intent of an API call. The model says, I want to retrieve this resource, or I want to create this record, and the protocol translates that into the appropriate HTTP request. But that translation layer has to make decisions. Which method, which headers, how to handle errors. Understanding those decisions means understanding HTTP.
And errors are where it gets interesting. HTTP has a rich error signaling system, status codes, response headers, error bodies with machine-readable details. If an AI agent gets a 429 too many requests, it needs to understand rate limiting and back off. If it gets a 401, it needs to reauthenticate. Teaching an AI to handle these gracefully requires that the humans building the system understand HTTP semantics deeply.
Let's bring this back to something concrete. If someone is looking at a request in Postman or their browser's network tab, and they want to actually understand what they're seeing, where should they start?
Start with the request line. What method is being used? GET means read. Post means create. PUT means replace. PATH means partial update. Delete means remove. What's the path? Does it have query parameters after a question mark? Those are filters or options. Then look at the headers. Content. Type tells you what format the body is in. Authorization tells you how the request is proving its identity. Accept tells you what the client expects back.
Then look at the response. What's the status code? 200 means it worked. 400 means you did something wrong. 500 means the server broke. The response headers tell you about caching, content format, and server identity. The response body is the actual data.
If you're debugging, the single most useful thing is to compare a working request to a broken one. What header is different? What parameter is missing? Is the content type wrong? Is the auth token expired? Most API debugging is just differential diagnosis. Find the difference, fix the difference.
The other practical tip, use the browser's network tab to see the cascade. Load a page, open DevTools, go to the network tab, and just watch. You'll see the initial HTML request, then the CSS and JavaScript files, then the API calls that fetch data. Each one is a full request response cycle. Seeing the sequence makes the architecture visible.
Pay attention to the timing breakdown. DevTools shows you DNS lookup time, TCP connection time, TLS handshake time, time to first byte, content download time. If a request is slow, the timing breakdown tells you where the bottleneck is. Is DNS slow? Is the server taking forever to respond? Is the payload too large? The data is there.
One more thing. The headers tab in DevTools shows you both request and response headers, but it also shows you general headers that apply to the entire transaction. Things like the request URL, the request method, the status code. It's a clean summary that Postman doesn't always give you. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact. The shortest war in recorded history was the Anglo-Zanzibar War of 1896, which lasted between 38 and 45 minutes. The Sultan's forces surrendered after a British naval bombardment, destroyed their palace, and disabled their artillery.
If we're pulling practical takeaways from all of this, I'd say there are three things listeners can actually do. First, open your browser's network tab and look at the requests your own applications are making. You'll learn more about how your app works in 10 minutes of inspection than in hours of reading documentation.
Second, if you use Postman or a similar tool, take the time to understand each field you're filling in. Don't just copy-paste headers from documentation. Understand what content type means, what authorization is doing, why that particular parameter is in the query string versus the body.
Third, when something breaks, and it will break, start with the status code. It's not just a number, it's the server's first communication about what went wrong. 401 means check your auth, 415 means check your content type. 429 means slow down. The status code is your first clue.
The bigger picture here is that HTTP is one of those technologies that's simultaneously simple and deep. The basics, method, path, headers, body, you can learn in an afternoon, but the subtleties, caching semantics, content negotiation, authentication flows, protocol version differences, those take years to master. And with AI agents increasingly operating at the HTTP layer, understanding what's actually happening on the wire is going to be a differentiator.
The abstraction is a gift, but the knowledge of what's underneath is the insurance policy. When the abstraction breaks, and it always breaks eventually, you need to be able to open the hood and diagnose the problem. That's the skill Daniel is reaching for, and it's absolutely the right instinct.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for making this show happen. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want more episodes like this one, head over to myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back with another one soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird.